It is a year since Sri Lanka's economy collapsed. A year of a once prosperous nation, knocked for six and trying to find its feet. Tourists are slowly returning, but there's malnutrition and loss of work. Now, last week, the IMF deal was announced, but it's questionable how much impact that will have on people's lives. I welcome to the program Dilokshan Francis, a head of research and evaluation at the Save the Children Sri Lanka, and Benjamin Parkin, who's the Financial Times South Asia correspondent. Dilokshan, I want to start with Benjamin, if you don't mind, because sometimes, well, a semi-outsider's view is quite telling. Ben, you're based in New Delhi, but you make frequent trips to Colombo, including last week. What does the visitor see now? Do you see a country in crisis?
Hi, Philip. Thanks for having me on. I think compared to a year ago or 6 months ago, you know, when you arrived in Sri Lanka, say in Colombo, I mean, it felt in many ways like a ghost town. The airport was practically empty. Streets were empty. People couldn't get fuel to leave the house. There were, you know, the main sign of life were queues, people waiting up to get cooking gas. Compared to that, it looks like, you know, it looks like the tourist sort of paradise. It looks like, in many ways, superficially, things have bounced back. Shops are full, streets are busy again. You see tourists coming in and out of malls and hotels, but that really masks the much less visible and lingering effects of the crisis, the hunger, the joblessness you mentioned, the massive hit to the standard of living that people have taken. So it's easy to think that the worst is over. In many ways, the worst is only beginning.
Now, so on the surface, a sense of normality, but beneath the surface, I understand you talk to people who want to leave the country.
Yes, quite a few, actually. You know, we spoke to some siblings, for example, Sajitra and Janalakshan, both around 30 years old. One of them didn't have a job and was all set to leave to the UAE. Another one did, but inflation was so high that, you know, his Janalakshan, his salary had become effectively meaningless. And this was a pretty widely held sentiment among the people we've spoken to, that they just don't see opportunity for the short term and indeed medium and long term.
Benjamin, so it's the second stage of the crisis. Have people's incomes fallen massively?
Yes, we'll take inflation, for example. I mean, inflation is currently running at about 50% year over year, and it was even higher a few months ago at like 70%. So people's purchasing power has dropped massively. So, you know, Sri Lanka was, relative to some of its neighbors, say India, Pakistan, other South Asian countries, quite prosperous on a per capita basis. Its per capita GDP was double that of India's before the crisis. And now it's fallen sharply. And people who were enjoying, you know, by those standards, quite a good quality of life have seen a lot of those gains disappear.
I understand it had quite a strong social safety net, you know, public services, education, health, social welfare schemes.
Yeah, it's all relative, but certainly when you compared it to some of its immediate neighbours, yeah, Sri Lanka had invested seriously in education, healthcare, in you know, ensuring that, you know, people were protected from you know, extreme poverty, and a lot of that has proved to be really really precarious now. You know, people are really struggling. At the height of the crisis, people were cooking with firewood because they couldn't get fuel. Now, you know, they can get fuel again, but how much food can they afford? Can they afford anything other than the absolute basics? Can they eat, you know, more than one or two meals a day? I mean, that's for Dilokshan to speak about more, but it's been a real sort of cratering of the system that had been created.
I'm talking to Benjamin Parkin, who's the Financial Times South Asia correspondent. In the past, you would have seen a lot of construction work going on. Is that resuming?
Well, it's slowly, some of it maybe, but pretty much there may be some appetite to restart deals, but I didn't see any evidence of massive rebuilding. I think that'll take time. That'll need a lot more money. You know, one of the people I spoke to, Jana Lakshan, who I already mentioned, actually worked for a state construction company. And one of the problems he cited was that a lot of the projects, you know, bridges, for example, had just ground to a halt.
Delukshan Francis, thanks for your patience. Your organisation, Save the Children, has done a couple of household surveys. What were the most startling findings when it comes to food?
Yes, thank you. So what we have done in following the crisis, Save the Children realised that the complex nature of the crisis that started to evolve, and we felt there might be more dimensions of how, in particular, the household being impacted by the crisis. So we done the first phase of the assessment in June 2022, and followed by the second phase of the assessment we carried out in December 2022. So what we have observed was, even though there are, as the previous speaker mentioned, you know, there were things we could see improved in terms of mobility and access to certain essential items. But however, the depleted capacity of household, because even though some of the household managed to increase income, but the expenses started doubled. So their household average income is never adequate. So what the household have done, they forced to send more members from their household to work. So from our survey, we have found in 36%, almost one in three household, where the spouses need to go to earn additionally on top of other members. So that leaves in particularly children at most at risk. More people started to migrate. If based on the statistics that we have derived from the immigration, more women tend to find better earning jobs in the Middle Eastern countries. And that also leaves children at risk because the primary caregiving lapses that cost. And in terms of food security, our survey has found nearly 36% of the household were not able to provide adequate nutritious food for their children, and nearly 50%, one in two household, were not able to spend on education. Because if we take the average spending of household, mainly they focus on food, education, and medicine. Those are the traditional group where the focus on spending. So where one in two were not able to spend on education, purely because in terms of average household expenditure required for education per one child has almost tripled when compared to 2 years ago. So based on the earning that they have, they can't prioritize children's education, where they have to focus on food security of children, of the families.
In 2017, there was surplus rice production. Now, every single food, including rice, has to be imported. All of this makes schooling so much more important. But there's a new barrier there too, isn't there? The entry cost.
Exactly. So, as you rightly mentioned, we were a surplus producers of rice. And almost every single item now we have to import. So in particular, these education materials, that's the reason for why we used to have this high cost, because all these products when got imported because of our inflated dollar, all the prices have been increased. And this even forced children, say if there are two children, our findings have revealed around 4 to 5%, where the children have to stop one child's education, especially they can't afford the new enrollment. So they have to support the other other child's based on how they choose their priority educations.
I understand that school was somewhere where children could be fed.
Correct. So Save the Children, together with the funding of USDA, US funding, were engaged in providing school meal program around 880 schools that covers around 120,000 children. So it's a program complements with the government school meal program where through our donors' gracious support, we provide salmon, dal, and coconut that complements the staple food of rice and other that was supported by the government funds. So it's a holistic meal that we provide. But the main objective of this school meal program is to engage children to study. Their active engagement in the education was the main focus. If you look at how households were struggling to provide nutritious food, and based on our survey finding, sending children to school to get this nutritious food is always the best option for the families.
Back to you, Benjamin Parkin. This all sounds appalling. What difference might the IMF loan make?
Well, in the immediate term, it could make some difference, but ultimately, it's a very long-term program aimed at long-term growth and gains. So the total value of the program is $3 billion spread over 4 years. Now, Sri Lanka has received around $330 million as of last week. So for a country that needs to import fuel, food, medicine, that's not actually very much money at the end of the day. What it does is it sends a potential kind of vote of confidence to a message to other investors, lenders, countries that this is, you know, this is an economy that's slowly recovering. And so, you know, we may see more deals, more loans, and so on. However, ultimately, it's a very long-term program that, you know, the government now has to embark on a multi-year reform program, which are going to be painful and in the short term could make things worse for certain demographics.
To put that $3 billion into perspective, Australia has just signed up for $300 odd billion for submarines. So $3 billion over 4 years is a pittance. But and of course, the IMF usually requires the recipient country to raise taxes and cut spending.
Yes, and the government of President Ranil Wickremesinghe has already done that, raised taxes quite sharply in a number of areas and cut, you know, for example, subsidies on fuel and so on. Now, the reality is Sri Lanka's tax base was very, very low. And it was an unsustainable situation, and it was one that had been created not to benefit ordinary Sri Lankans, but, you know, to benefit sort of powerful, politically connected demographics of businesses and so on. So these are changes that most people I speak to agree were needed, but it's unclear how much there is to protect those who will be hard hit in the interim. If you're the value of your salary is already dissipating because of inflation and you have to pay more tax, where does that leave you?
Benjamin, we talked about the pending IMF loan on the program a year ago. Why did it take so long?
So, yes, the former Sri Lankan president first approached the IMF about a year ago. They had agreed a what's called a staff-level sort of preliminary agreement by September, but then it took around 6 months to actually get the funds and finalize the deal. The reason is that because when the IMF lends to a bankrupt country, they require that country, in this case Sri Lanka, to go to its other lenders and agree some kind of debt relief deal first. So in other words, they need to convince the people who have lent them money to, you know, give them some kind of break on what they're supposed to repay. Now, in this case, that involved India, that involved Japan, and crucially, that involved China, which, and this is where, you know, Sri Lanka's case becomes of real importance to the rest of the world, and it's being very closely watched. China has become a huge lender to low and middle income countries over the past couple of years. And so now when we're seeing other countries struggle with debt distress because of the slowing global economy, inflation and so on, more and more countries are going to be going to China and asking them for help. So in this case, China was reluctant to agree to some kind of restructuring deal. Eventually it did, which paved the way for the IMF to disperse the money. But it's, that process as well is not over. Now they have to actually finalize an agreement. So it could yet drag out. The program could yet be held up.
Dilukshan, we're running out of time, but we should also remember there have been so many things for the Sri Lankans to struggle with. There was the tsunami in 2004, 2006, the peak of the civil conflict, and, of course, natural disasters, floods and droughts.
Exactly. So we used to consider that if you take the average economically disadvantaged household, they often live in these disaster-prone locations because they can't afford to, the land become one of their biggest issues. So if you take the history of the disasters, since tsunami, these particular vulnerable households never had the time to recover because there were compounding shocks of man-made and natural hazards that never provided them time to recover or stabilize their economic conditions. And what we had was the global level impact. War in Ukraine that impacts on the tourism, because normally Sri Lanka has the higher volume of tourism from those part of the world, and also the Sri Lankan tea is mainly purchased by those part of the world as well. So that has a very severe impact on our country's economy.
Troubles upon troubles upon troubles. There's so much more to tell, but unfortunately we're out of time, and I thank you both for your contribution. Dilukshan Francis, Head of Research and Evaluation at Save the Children Sri Lanka, and thank you, Benjamin Parkin, Financial Times South Asia correspondent.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.